This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is John Peterson, the Executive Director of Aviation at Iridium Communications. We talk about satellite constellations and communications with commercial aircraft, general aviation aircraft, drones, and even handheld devices. In the news this episode, we've lost an aviation icon. The U.S. Department of Transportation's Office of Inspector General report looks at the state of the FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. An unruly passenger pays a price after interfering with a flight crew. A second Boeing whistleblower dies. Possible ways to address troubling reports that airlines are engaged in unfair, abusive, and deceptive practices. And why multiple airliners started squawking the 7700 emergency distress code at the same time. All that and more is coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 798 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Although I'm somewhat questioning that, given the last 15 minutes of technical difficulties. But with me is first our main man, Micah.
Hey, everybody. Great to be here. And I guess we're just doing a satellite broadcast tonight.
We are. I'm in my camper. I'm in a parking lot. I've got Starlink outside. I've got the big Blue Eddy power station out there powering that. And we're going to see if we can get this to work. And you may hear a little bit of noise because I'm actually right adjacent to the, to a volunteer fire department. And I picked this location because I've got great view of the sky, terrific for Starlink. But it turns out that Monday evenings is when the volunteer firefighters all get together and do their training and testing. And I don't know what's going to go on outside the camper, but if you hear some strange noises, that's what that's all about. So speaking of strange noises, also with us is Rob Mark. He's a bizjet pilot, a journalist, and he's also a publisher at jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening to everybody from Chicago. And I'm glad all these folks from Iridium are here tonight because I want to learn everything I can about LEOs and why they don't run into each other. And I'm really excited about tonight.
Yeah, and you're going to be an expert. We're all going to be an expert on this topic coming up. But also with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, all. Hopefully everything's fine. It is kind of funny when the Jedi Master has technical difficulties of all these years, but you know, our guest has provided some solutions. But you know, after 14 years of doing this, every solution we've probably tried at least once, and it still didn't work.
I think so. Some of them work, some of them don't. I'll mention that Max Trescott is off again. This week, kind of suddenly, turns out that I think he forgot, but it turns out that he has a birthday party with his grandson. So he's off doing that right now. So let me introduce our guest this episode. It's John Peterson. He's the Executive Director of Aviation at Iridium Communications. Now, they're the only satellite communications company that offers global voice and data coverage. In this role, John helps deliver Iridium's safety, voice, and data solutions to pilots and operators. He's an aviation enthusiast himself, a private pilot. He's worked in the industry for 30 years in a number of different roles, including engineering and product management. Also, he's had leadership roles at Boeing and Collins, Gogo, and Honeywell. So, John, it's great to have you on the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here and be around all you distinguished airplane geeks. I'm looking forward to talking to you about Iridium and learning a little bit more from you guys about airplanes. I loved your spot on Boom. That was a great podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was a lot of fun.
We've talked to Iridium before, but not in a long time. Specifically, we talked to Iridium's CEO, Matt Desch,
quite a few years ago. I think it was about 2017. So it's about time to get caught up, and John's here to help us do that. And we're going to talk about how better, faster data throughput can improve on-time performance, and a lot of other topics as well. First, we're going to start off with some of the news, some of the aviation news from the past week. All right, our first story. Well, let me just say this. Most of us are average. We lead average lives. We accomplish average things. But some people are remarkable. They lead extraordinary lives. They accomplish great things. And Dick Rutan was one of those people. Now, sadly, Dick passed a few days ago at age 85. Now, it's almost impossible to kind of encapsulate Dick Rutan. I mean, he was an Air Force pilot, a Vietnam War veteran. He flew 325 missions. He was a test pilot. He flew the first unrefueled nonstop flight around the world with Gina Yeager. That was in the Rutan Voyager that was designed by his brother, Bert. Dick Rutan and Mike Melville flew two Rutan long, easy aircraft around the world. That was as the Spirit of EAA Friendship World Tour. Dick also set the point-to-point distance record for ground-launched rocket-powered aircraft. Just think about that for a minute. Now, he died from complications of long COVID in Idaho on May 3rd this year, 2024. As I mentioned, he was 85. His brother, Bert, had an interesting comment, which was, he said of his brother, he played an airplane like someone plays a grand piano. And I think that kind of summed it up. I had the pleasure of meeting Dick and Bert at the Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Dayton, maybe about 4 years ago, something that. And it was amazing to meet, you know, both of the brothers, completely different personalities between the two of them, but both fascinating. I don't know, David, can you think of any other things about, I mean, there are so many, but any other notable accomplishments?
From a military history background, we talked a couple of weeks ago to someone who flew a 01 Bird Dog as a forward air controller. Dick flew what they call the F-100F Super Sabre and was what they call a MISTI FAC or forward air controller. The Air Force flew F-100s in Vietnam as forward air controllers. So, and their job was to basically get shot at so that they could lead in the other aircraft. Most people spend their whole careers, don't eject out of an aircraft once if they're lucky. Dick ejected twice, you know, so Martin Baker, I'm not sure if it was what Martin Baker's that were in, but he ejected twice out of F-100s, once based out of Europe, and then a second time based out of when he was flying in Vietnam. So he retired as a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force and then went on to have a real flying career, of course, with Voyager and the rest of them. And it must be a really nice experience to have your brother design airplanes for you. You know, that is kind of...
If your brother likes you.
If your brother likes you, yeah. Well, that's true. But Dick's steady hand and flying skills, if anybody knows about Voyager, they lost a wingtip at the beginning of their round-the-world flight. And because the wings were so flexible, it bounced off the ground and they broke a wingtip. But both Jenna and Dick were able to circumnavigate the world even with the broken wing. So testament to Bert's design of an aircraft, but also the flying skills of Dick, who did the takeoffs and the landings.
I think that Bert's response to his brother's passing about him being able to fly an airplane like a pianist, or you know, grand pianist that plays the piano. I mean, it made me look back into his background because having flown F-100s, when I was in the Air Force, I was stationed in Europe, and we had two squadrons of F-100s at our base in England. And I found out that at the same time that I was down at RAF Wethersfield with two, the 55th and the 77th TAC fighter wing of F-100s, Dick was up the road at RAF Lakenheath in F-100s. And that's where he ended up on a training mission punching out. And I thought, wow, if I'd have known, but then I don't think he was anybody special then. He was just, you know, he just got through two or 300 missions in Vietnam without getting shot down. I mean, except for that. I mean, he was nobody special. I mean, seriously, can you believe? I mean, we think, you know, when we fly airplanes to civilians, and I always hear military guys, and I think, yeah, but I don't care what it sounds like I did, but nothing compares to what you guys did. And they were shooting at you. They were trying to knock you out of the sky with guns and missiles and wow, just unbelievable. So he'll be missed.
All right, well, let's press onward. This is an item from AIN Online. DOT Inspector General report faults FAA next gen progress. Now, you probably recall the next generation air transportation system, next gen, is a very large scale FAA initiative to modernize the U.S. national airspace system. Now, the FAA describes next gen, talking about next gen, the FAA says that next gen is modernized air traffic infrastructure and communications, navigation, surveillance, automation, and information management with the aim of increasing the safety, efficiency, capacity, predictability, flexibility, and resiliency of American aviation. NextGen scope includes airport infrastructure improvements, new air traffic technologies and procedures, and safety and security enhancements. Well, now we see in this AIN story, Rob, that U.S. Department of Transportation's Office of Inspector General has issued a report taking a look at NextGen. And what did they find, Rob?
What they found, you know, just so people are familiar, the DOT's Inspector General is kind of the, hey, what's going on out there, guys, kind of people. And they create these reports from time to time on various aspects of our national transportation system. But what, of course, now, next gen, people may have been hearing it recently, but next gen has been coming for more than 20 years. And it's not here yet. We do kind of keep waiting because when FAA gets a hold of anything, or at least in my experience, when FAA gets a hold of anything that demands precise technology, they don't actually do that well at translating the plan to the operational technology. And what they did this time is, you know, of course, the IG looked at what the FAA promised versus what they said they have right now and how much money they have spent over the last 20 years. And I think that without going into all the details of the amount of money, you know, the FAA and the IG are both somewhat at odds over what the actual benefits are that the system is actually agreed. I'm looking for a good word here. It hasn't quite done everything that they were expecting that it would. And so we keep waiting for the FAA to kind of get their act together. But again, we're going to see if this is going to happen. And the IG says, well, you know, so far we're kind of impressed, but we're not that impressed. And, we looked at the trajectory-based operations that we were going to have, you know, available to us, which would be, you know, a lot of curved approaches from high altitude landing at Kennedy or landing at O'Hare or LAX, and it kind of didn't quite come together yet. There's the Terminal Flight Data Manager, which is a beauty. It had a lot of good things in the plan for how controllers would actually work inside an in-route center or inside a Tracon. And one of the best ones, I think, are the electronic flight strips. Now, people that have not been controllers wouldn't know, but we all used to work with little paper strips that would identify the flight number and the type aircraft and the speed and the altitude and the flight plan so that we could say, okay, all right, you know, this guy's coming out, and then behind him are four more aircraft, and we'd stack them up in a row, and that's how we knew who was first and second and third. And someone would, you know, as the ground controller, as a clearance delivery person finished with it, he'd hand the strip over to the ground controller, and then when the guy called ground, he'd go, yeah, that's this guy, and he'd hold the strip in his hand, and then when he got him to the runway, he'd take the strip over to the local controller who was going to clear him for takeoff and give them the strip. And then after the aircraft departed, that strip would get shoved down a tube to the Tracon down in the basement, and it would appear in front of the correct radar controller, so that when the guy blasted off from the ground and they appeared on the radar scope, they'd have the right strip in front. Well, that's a very, very ancient way of doing things. And the FAA has been trying for ages and ages to get past this kind of paperwork problem. And they have in the in-route centers, they're running with electronic strips. It's just, you know, it's just an image on a screen, and they use a little pen and they can manipulate it just as they would a paper strip. But it hasn't worked well in a tower. They have not been able to make it work. And unfortunately, they gave the contract to develop. We can't do it anymore. Let's just give it to a contractor who knows what they're doing. And they gave this contract to Lockheed Martin back in, I don't know, 2017 or 2018 to create this system. And Lockheed Martin says it's going to take 12 years. So by 2030, we will have this electronic flight strip system that the center's already using, but we've got to have a completely different system that works way differently, but it's going to be way better if we can make it work. And so far, it hasn't come to be. Well, the only reason I'm even mentioning it is that our neighbors to the north, Nav Canada, who run air traffic, granted, we don't have they don't have a system up there that's near as complex or as busy as ours. But the one thing the Canadians can do well is that they can see a problem and they can figure out a great answer, and they know how to create design the technology to solve the problem. And in this case, they came up with an electronic flight strip system in Canada, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, something like that. Works great. In fact, it's so good, the NAV Canada folks, again, designed it, tested it in-house. They hired a contractor to build the product, and NAV Canada sells it to air traffic control systems all around the world. So you'd think, all we've got to do is drive to Montreal, and we can just have ourselves. Well, FAA doesn't work like that. So they have to have it their way. They've got to design it on their own, and of course, it still doesn't work. And these are the kinds of practical topics that the IG is saying, guys, yeah, I see what you're saying, but life does not quite line up the way that we were hoping to. And of course, you might remember too, we had a story, a Jetwine, latter part of last year, about the remote control tower technology that FAA let slip through their fingers as well. They had a test site at Leesburg in Virginia and another one out in Colorado. And FAA said, no, way too complicated. We can't do that. So we're going to start from scratch and we're going to design it from the get-go and it'll be great. And now nobody anywhere is doing it, except, of course, the people outside the United States. You know, NAV Canada works with a system. Saab, the Swedes, have had a system in place in Europe for years. And unfortunately, again, it's just this is the part that just drives me crazy, is I don't understand why FAA just can't let go of itself. It just cannot say, you know what, rather than try to redesign it, it never seems to work. Why don't we just get these guys that know what they're doing, bring them on board, pay them for their time, get the thing to work and move on and solve more complex problems with the air traffic system. And so that's kind of what this whole IG report is looking at in depth, to say, again, have you guys really delivered on what you promised us for the amount of, well, I'll never say on budget. They're never on budget. They're always over budget. It's kind of like back in the old days when we were talking tanker stories, and David knows what that's like, that nobody that contracts with the government ever gets it in at the amount of money that they expect. So, but again, it was a look-see, and I'm sure there's going to be another one coming up in the next year or two to see if FAA has improved at all. We're going to keep our fingers crossed.
I was just going to say, is it any wonder this is going so slow? These are the same people that can't come up with a personnel staffing schedule so that everybody gets the right amount of sleep.
That's true, too. It's
you guys make it really hard to not say something.
Oh, come on. Come on. We don't mind. Go ahead. If you see this very differently, we'd love to hear another opinion, John.
I'm so afraid of a ramp check. I'm just going to stay quiet.
Okay.
Random ramp check.
Well, we'll have links in the show notes to the report, also to the recommendations. The IG made three recommendations, in some ways kind of not unexpected. And the FAA has agreed to those recommendations. I think we'll be talking about next gen for quite a while. We've been talking about it for a long time as it is, and we'll probably be talking about it for many more years to come. You know, one thing we've talked about from time to time is unruly passengers. And as you might suspect, when this crowd here is confronted with news about an unruly passenger, we always like to see the book get thrown at them, the hammer dropped, whatever. But this is about a passenger from England on a United flight from London to Newark, New Jersey. And I guess, Rob, it started out with a loud argument with his girlfriend, but then the thing kind of escalated and they end up diverting the flight.
Go back a couple of years during COVID, and that could have happened here in the States. We don't seem to have as many of those incidents here in the States. But I still believe wholeheartedly that an awful lot that has to do with these kind of incidents has alcohol mixed in somewhere along the way, either alcohol or some kind of, you know, somebody was smoking pot or something, and they just lose control of themselves. And they're not nice people anymore. I mean, you can disagree with the something that a flight attendant asks you to do, like, sir, if you're going to have a problem keeping your sense of normalcy here on the airplane with your girlfriend, can we maybe move you to the baggage compartment or the equipment bay where you won't bother anybody? But again, and so this poor fellow, he's actually from Chelmsford in England, which I happen to know where that is. I was mentioning I was stationed in England. Chelmsford was the big town up the road from us, and nice town. I always thought the people were very friendly. But you know, again, when people would get started at the pub, things would get a little out of hand. But again, on an airplane, I'm sorry, there's no room for that. And then he became belligerent with the flight attendant, and then he said the cardinal the cardinal sin. He uttered those bad words. I'm just going to mess this airplane up. And any flight attendant would say, okay, you're done. It's all over. And how they managed to get this guy in those plastic cuffs that they put on him.
Flex cuffs.
Flex cuffs. And they diverted the flight to Micah's backyard. And they tried to deliver this guy to Micah's front door, but he refused delivery of him. So they arrested him and took him to the Hoosegow. Now, they didn't say whether he actually no, I think it did say that. He did have a few physical altercations with his girlfriend and possibly the flight attendant. And again, I'm sorry. There's nowhere that should be happening in an airplane. I mean, I don't think it should be happening anywhere, but I mean, in an airplane with 100 or 200 people around you that must not only watch it, but could get involved or dragged into this thing. No, not happening. So United fined him $21,000, which, as Mike and I were talking before the show, I doubt seriously that covered the complete cost of the diversion to Bangor, because then, of course, they started the airplane up. They kicked him out, started it up again, headed back to Newark. And Micah, I can see your hand is raised. Go, Micah.
I think he got off easy for a lot of reasons. First of all, $20,638 is not a lot of money based on what United had to pay and the inconvenience to the other passengers and the fear that the other passengers would have had seeing all that happen. Second of all, he may or may not be judgment-proof in terms of trying to collect that $20,000. United may never see it. On top of that, it's a felony crime that's punishable up to 20 years in prison. Up to 20 years. The judge gave him time served, which was about 30 days from the time he was locked up until the time of the trial. Time served. And we don't see whether United banned him from flying anymore. But if a person cannot behave in a society in a confined space and isn't capable of showing that kind of courtesy and behavior, not even necessarily courtesy, but just appropriate behavior without threatening someone, I don't believe that that person should be flying anywhere. That's when you separate someone from society for a situation like that because they can't behave. And that means you also can't trust that person to behave that way or behave appropriately again. And I know that's a very hard way of looking at it. And I know many other people, because I've argued about this with people on different chats here and there, don't necessarily agree with me. But you lose your rights when you cause that kind of trouble.
And I wonder if the other passengers, I don't think this has ever happened, has it file a civil suit claiming, you know, damage? I mean, if they were to, if they were on their way to one of their children's wedding and they missed the wedding, or they were on a business trip and they were unable to complete what they were trying to do, the inconveniences to the other passengers can be really significant. And I just wonder if they couldn't file a civil suit. I don't think that's ever happened. You think some enterprising lawyer would kind of think of that first. But, and then the other thing is, I don't see any mention of where he stands with his girlfriend now. So I don't know how they worked that out.
But Max, even if they did file a civil suit, odds are at this point, and I don't know, $20,000 is a lot of money. A civil suit, the guy could be judgment proof, so there's no point in filing one.
Yeah, I don't know. If it was me, I would do it just to spite the guy, I guess. But all right. Well, we know where we stand on this one. All right. Hey, moving on to Slate.com. This is was foul play involved in the Boeing whistleblowers, that's plural, deaths. People are definitely worried about it. And a second Boeing whistleblower has died. In this case, it was a 45-year-old man. He passed after becoming suddenly ill. And it was just 2 months ago that another whistleblower was found dead in his truck from a gunshot wound. And I don't know if they've figured out what was behind that. But I don't know. You know, when I saw the news of the second whistleblower's death, my first reaction was that the conspiracy theorists are just going to go nuts with this, and it's going to get completely out of hand. I just don't see that there's anything to be concerned about at this point, conspiracy wise. I don't know. Do you guys agree?
There's a second article about this that was in the Seattle Times, written by Dominic Gates, that talked about the situation, and I'll put that in the notes for us to be able to share. But it says that he became ill. He went to the hospital. He was having trouble breathing 2 weeks ago. He was intubated in the hospital. He developed pneumonia and then a serious bacterial infection known as MRSA. If you're familiar with MRSA, that's a methicillin-resistant staphylococcus, which is incredibly contagious. There isn't a lot of cures for. And so, conspiracy, I don't know. I tend to follow Occam's razor, and Occam's razor basically says if you have two competing ideas to explain the same phenomenon, you go with the simple one.
Well, okay. I mean, if that's the way you want to look at it. No, and seriously, the lady that wrote the Slate story, Christine Negroni, we've had on the show before, and I know her from journalistic circles too. And Christine's not easily flappable. I mean, she's a hard nose. I want the facts. And she said, but boy, doesn't this just look strange? I mean, Boeing's problems alone would be enough to make anybody wonder these days. And then the first guy that just blows the whistle happens to die. And this fellow happens to pass. Yes, I know exactly what you're saying, Micah, that, it is what it is, but it just looks really weird. So I haven't actually heard any conspiracy theory, anything. I haven't even seen that story appear in any of the media here in Chicago. It didn't even make news. So I guess maybe the conspiracy thing is just not, making it through the filters anywhere.
I think it's let the professional investigators, deal with this. And in the meantime, to me, it's just a coincidence. And, unless somebody comes up with something concrete and definitive and credible, I'm on to the next story.
Oh, you always want to take the easy way out.
Yeah. Well, it's really another conspiracy theory, except this one's about airline points.
But if we're going to put nails in the coffin from a certain Boeing, or as we record this on May 6th, Boeing's launch for their rocket tonight has been scrubbed.
Oh, it was scrubbed?
Oh, no.
Oh, the Starliner.
For Starliner. Unfortunately, what it looks like, though, is the scrub had nothing to do with the Boeing product, Starliner, but the United Earth, Launch Alliance Atlas, the Centaur, had a failure. So Boeing's just luck is just gotten worse. When it gets bad, it gets bad. And when it gets bad, it gets worse.
All right. The bad news about your airline points. This is from CNN. Two authors. One of the authors is Ganesh Sitaraman, who was our guest on episode 774. He wrote the book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. But he points out that, or this article points out that it's harder to gain status on Delta. Alaska has increased the points needed for some destinations. American has limited what tickets earn points. Some airlines stop posting redemption charts, so you don't know what your points are worth, and the airlines can change them whenever they want because they're not published. Some airlines sometimes charge more for mileage multipliers than what the points are actually worth. And some airlines charge a fee to transfer points. So the whole airline affinity program thing, the frequent flyer program thing, has just become increasingly less attractive. And I don't know. I just don't pay any attention to points anymore.
I don't either. And I don't know if I were a frequent flyer these days, if I would bother with points any longer, because they just don't seem to be worthwhile. I think you're better off looking for the best fare and not really worry about accruing points. But they liken the points in this article to your coffee punch card at a cafe where, you know, your 11th coffee is free. When you get, you know, 10 punches, you get the 11th one for free. And, you know, you think about that. You're buying your coffee at this special cafe, and what's a coffee these days at those kind of places? $6. So for every $60 you spend on coffee, you get one free cup. Something about that just doesn't sound right. And it's the same thing how the points are working these days. The article goes on to say that it's just a terrible lack of transparency, and that Congress ought to get involved. Although I'm not sure if Congress should be looking at these points, because this is, you know, this is such a minor thing, and, you know, P.T. Barnum was right, and that's just how it goes.
Just what we need is Congress involved in this.
Being a guy who's flown over 100,000 miles a year for the last 30 years, sometimes 200,000 miles a year, I'll tell you what, ever since the airlines realized that they make more money on the credit card fees than they ever make on getting business travelers to be loyal to them, they were willing to trade one for the other. So that is really what's going on. The points programs were loyalty programs. That's what they were originally called. Now they just have credit cards. So they don't need the loyalty programs because they use the credit cards and the fees and the interest gained in order to offset the loyalty revenue. And now they can compete and we get cheaper tickets. It's just one offsets the other.
And it's not just the airlines that are deep into credit cards. I mean, if I look at my wallet, I've got so many credit cards from so many different businesses that I, you know, do, you know, conduct business with. It's kind of gotten out of hand.
So wait a minute. So you've got a pocket full of credit cards from all kinds of businesses, and you're running this show from the back end of a truck in a parking lot on you know, solar power. Couldn't you go get a hotel? Even Motel 6 has internet access.
Yeah, well, just because I have a lot of credit cards doesn't mean I'm not cheap.
Frugal, Max. Frugal is the appropriate word.
I agree.
All right, one more news item. Let's talk about squawking 7700. Rob, tell our non-pilot listeners what squawking 7700 is all about.
Pilots probably know that there's a transponder in most airplanes these days that makes it easier for air traffic on the ground to see you and identify you. Aircraft often fly, when they're IFR, they all fly on a different transponder code. But in case of an emergency, the first item is put 7700 in the box. And that at an air traffic control, either the center or a TRACON, an aircraft that's squawking 7700 becomes very, very prominent on a radar scope. It beeps, it flashes, so that no air traffic controller worth his metal could possibly miss the fact that this aircraft is having a problem. They may not know what it is at just that moment, but it's to alert everybody in the area, stay the Sam Hill away from this aircraft, because who knows what is going on. So, again, that's where Squawk 7700 came from. And another time, when we have more time, I'll explain to you why they call it, why they say they squawk as opposed to anything else.
So, Micah, in this case, we had a number of aircraft squawking 7700 all about at the same time, and some people got kind of curious as to what the heck was going on.
Yeah, and you know, when you see a bunch of aircraft in the same general area squawking 7700, you start to really worry. But it turned out this took place through Maastricht ATC, and it had to do with a bunch of thunderstorms being formed over Belgium, and a bunch of aircraft wanted to be rerouted around these thunderstorms. ATC said the only reroute is taking you through an area of airspace where there's a bunch of military training taking place. So squawk 7700, because that way the military pilots would definitely be able to identify you as the pilot of the commercial flight and probably avoid any serious incidents. So although the code is reserved for emergencies, like Rob said, in this case, it just sounds a little strange. They were informed by ATC to squawk 7700 so they could be identified flying through this route that I guess was closed off to commercial airspace at the time.
So, Rob, is that an improper use of that?
I'd say it is. Yes. I mean, if a controller can't figure out a way to reroute an aircraft other than to say, you guys all go this way, squawk emergency, and it'll all work out. I mean, that's just insane. It's absolutely insane. And beside the fact that the 7700 code that we're talking about is available to controllers, the military pilots that were in this area would never be able to see it because they don't display those codes in their aircraft. Now, if some military controller on the ground said, hey, Poppy 23, we've got 11 aircraft in your vicinity, all squawking emergency. Any pilot would say, well, I guess I better get out of their way. I mean, but you want to talk about conspiracy? This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And I'll bet you that the controller who suggested this probably got a little time off.
Again, we're speaking with John Peterson from Iridium. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of a refresher on the different kinds of data that pass through or collected by aircraft and how that relates to on-time performance.
Absolutely. So first of all, love what you did with the news and the current news. I'll tell you all right now, I had to hold my tongue the whole way through it. Otherwise, you never would have finished. That was a lot of fun for me. I have been in aviation so long, so thank you for that. And I always set it to 7700 in my Cherokee when I had to go to the bathroom real bad because it was easier to get to the ground. So I didn't realize that was for something else. So thanks for that. I'll never do that again. So when we take a look at data and we take a look at what's going on, Iridium is what you call an L-band service. And what that means is L-band is a frequency that works in moisture. So if you got clouds, you got rainy weather, you've got bad weather, our frequency goes through that. VHF goes through it. HF goes through it. It's a very reliable frequency. And so in that case, it is permitted to be used for safety. So you can use it for getting your aircraft position for tracking off. You can use it for getting your aircraft location. You can use it for getting key parameters off the aircraft. So when you take a look at things like controller pilot data link, which is in that famed thing called next gen that's going to happen in the next generation of pilots that comes along, I'm sure. But when all of this stuff happens, it's got to happen over a frequency that you absolutely know is going to get through. And so L-band satellite communications is a frequency they know is going to get through. And so that happens when you want to get your surveillance data across or you want to get critical pilot communications to air traffic control across. That's where I would put it as the top level.
And that's completely separate from in-flight connectivity that the passengers would be looking for.
Yeah. So in-flight connect. So Max, from what I understand, you've got a lot of experience with things like KU connectivity when you're trolling around in your camper and you're doing your podcasts. And the K bands, the KU and the KA bands, they don't work so well when it's really bad weather. So anybody who's had Hughes TV, DirecTV, satellite TV, and you're watching the big game, and God help you if you live in a place like Chicago, so you got to dodge the bullets and you got to avoid the bad weather. And what happens when the bad weather comes is the picture gets real fuzzy and it says it loses the signal. And that's because the frequency is so high in KU and KA band, it doesn't go through the weather. So those sorts of things are much higher data rate. So people talk about, hey, if I have Starlink or I have some sort of KU, KA system on my aircraft, I can watch Netflix, I can stream video, I can watch TV on Southwest Airlines. All of those things are because they're very high data rate, high frequency KA and KU bands but you got to be above the clouds for it to work reliably.
Reliably. And so there's that difference. Whereas if you're looking at safety data or data associated with the safety of aircraft, operating the aircraft, maybe the data rates don't need to be quite so high, but the reliability has to be perfect or as close to it as you can get.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And then when you start talking about getting a greater level of reliability, then it's not so much also about the frequency, but it's about the infrastructure that's available. So when you're flying across the United States, there's it's very well funded. There is a lot of infrastructure. There's a lot of VHF infrastructure. There's a lot of surveillance infrastructure at 1090 and 978 megahertz. There's tons and tons of ground infrastructure, the best the Attorney General could possibly find in terms of putting all of our tax dollars into it. So there you get something that's very reliable. But what happens when you get in the North Atlantic tracks? What happens if you're flying across the Pacific? What happens if you're going from Sao Paulo to South Africa? There's no infrastructure. They don't have VHF towers out there floating in the ocean. So what you got to do is you got to have some sort of a reliable means of communication that's satellite-based. It's got to be satellite-based, and it's got to work in all weather conditions, because for whatever reason, pilots seem to want to do the most talking, or they want the most information when the weather sucks. They're looking at great big nasty clouds, and they're forward-looking weather radar, and they're thinking to themselves, well, I can't fly through it. So, well, I can try, but I might not make it through it. So what do? Do I turn left or do I turn right to go around it? Well, your forward-looking weather radar can't tell you that, because it goes out, bounces off the weather, and comes back. So you got to talk to somebody. Hey, do I turn left to go around that front that's in front of me, or do I turn right to go around the front that's in front of me? And that's where you really are using the satellite communications in areas where there just isn't a lot going on.
Now, you said you're using L-band and that it's for data, but it's also for voice. I'm curious, in terms of the average listener, when they talk about internet speeds, they're talking about megabytes per second. What kind of speed are you getting in terms of that data, and how can you do voice as well? Or is it that fast that the voice is going over data as well?
So let's kind of break that question up a little bit, because there's the old stuff that used to be Iridium before we launched Iridium Certus. So let's call that our Iridium Legacy. So in Iridium Legacy, a channel is only 2.4 kilobits per second. It's a physical limitation of the frequency of 1612 megahertz. So the way they set it up was they set it up so that there's a voice codec and a channel that gets connected, like a telephone line that goes from your house to the house next door, and you talk over that telephone line. And so it's a very reliable connection, which is why Iridium has always been a preferred voice connection globally over satellite communication. So when we talk about data, it's very different. Data is something that's best effort. So if the satellite is trying to put a lot of power into making absolutely certain that connection is maintained, a voice call over a channel gets way higher priority than data over those. And then there's other cascading things that happen. So the voice is very high reliably on both the legacy as well as the new satellites we have up now, Certus, because it's the same protocol. It's the same codec for the voice quality.
And these are low Earth orbit satellites?
Yeah, so that's another interesting thing to know when we're talking about satellite communications and how these things work globally. So typically what happens is somebody, you got to think of a satellite like a flashlight out in space. So if you got a flashlight and you shine it against the wall, the beam shows up against the wall. So Michael, what happens when you walk backwards away from the wall? What happens to the satellite beam?
It gets smaller, tighter.
Walking away from the wall, it gets bigger.
Oh, okay.
Closer to the wall, it gets smaller, right?
Gotcha.
That's all right. We gotcha. So that's very important, because the closer a satellite is to the Earth, the smaller the beam is it projects on the Earth, right? It works just like a flashlight does against a wall. So you need more satellites if you're going to cover the Earth. So if you look at a geostationary satellite that's way out, so far away, so far out in space, as the Earth rotates, it rotates at the same speed. The satellite follows the Earth at the same speed the Earth rotates. That can cover a third of the Earth. So you put up three satellites in between plus and minus 40 degrees latitude, you can cover that whole Earth, which is most of what the most of what landmass is. However, with low Earth satellites, they travel in a manner that goes from the North Pole to the South Pole for Iridium. That's an orbital plane, so they're just looping around the Earth on the orbital plane. And they charge up on the sunny side of the Earth, and they drain the batteries on the dark side of the Earth. So each orbital plane has 11 satellites on it. And then there's six orbital planes, 66 satellites, and then we have a bunch of spares up there, just in case something happens. So that's how we completely coat the Earth. But there's another thing about satellites that's very clever that is difficult to figure out. But how does a satellite get the data to the ground? So you got 66 satellites up there. They're all spinning around the Earth. A geostationary, one satellite sitting out there, can have one ground station it looks at, and the data goes up. And then it goes down to that ground station. It never moves, right? It's always in the same spot all the time. But what do you do with these satellites that are going about 60,000 miles an hour around the Earth? How do you land that data? So the way you land that data is you have to have a teleport on the ground to land it. So what Iridium engineers did 20-some years ago that only just now others are starting to figure out how to do is Iridium figured out how to make the satellites talk to each other, crosslinks. So you can be in the North Pole with an Iridium phone, sending a text message to Max, giving him some ideas of how to fix his audio issues on his Starlink. And while that is bouncing across the satellites around the world, it'll land in Tempe, and then we'll give it to Max as a message on his iPhone, and it'll fix everything. Whereas with a lot of other people, as that flashlight goes over the Earth, you send a message up to it, it's got no place to land it. It's got to fly a long ways before it can land it. And by that time, Max would have figured it out, and the message is no good to him.
I love the flashlight in the wall analogy. That really lets you visualize that pretty well. Iridium is involved in different aviation sectors, not just commercial aviation, but also general aviation, business aviation. What's Iridium's role in that segment?
This is where Iridium Certus is really exciting in how we're supporting the other segments of the market. So if you take a look at something like business aviation, we've always been the most reliable. We're kind of like the bat phone, the red phone in the back of the aircraft. When every other form of communication is not working, you walk over to the handset, you pick it up, it's an Iridium handset, you know you can make a phone call. It's always how we've been for 20-some years since this whole thing began. With Iridium Certus, because we have up to 700 kilobits per second, now what folks are doing is they're saying, hey, this is a great companion product to the KU and the KA bands. Because now when we're flying around the world, if you go too far north, those geostationary satellites can't see the airplane antenna. Anybody who flies the North Atlantic track, anybody who flies the shortcuts over the pole, at least when you used to be able to, all of the people doing those sorts of things understand that when the person in the back who spent $65 million for their airplane suddenly loses the internet, they get a little upset about it. And so Iridium's this perfect companion product where they can still stay productive. You're not going to watch Netflix, but you sure can get your work done, make phone calls, and you can fly all the way up over the poles. So you can go from Minneapolis to India, or you can go from Minneapolis over to China or whatever you want to do, and you can still maintain connection. And so that's the place where our new 700 kilobits per second really become handy. Another place that has become handy is in the mid-sized jets. So you take a look at things like Bombardier Challenger 3500s, the Pilatus PC-24. These are aircraft that are used for a broad range of reasons as a mid-size aircraft. So putting really big, heavy, expensive KA systems on those aircraft may not be what that mission demands, particularly for a leasing company. So what they'll do is they'll get something like an Iridium Certus system on there, and they can still have the cabin. What I call it's all about that sort of connectivity is used more for performance and more for productivity, not entertainment. And so you can still have productivity. So people can lease your aircraft and still work, or the principal can be flying the aircraft in Asia Pacific region and all these other parts of the world and still maintain connectivity, but not have to pay so much for the system and for the service.
Let me ask you this, John. I'm not very well informed in terms of the infrastructure and the sort of the equivalent of the application. So Iridium is certainly providing the infrastructure, right? The satellites, the basic system. But in terms of, you know, if this was a computer, the applications, does Iridium provide those as well? Or is that available for other parties to develop off of the Iridium platform?
That's the greatest part about our model. It's the part, one of the things I'm proudest of with the Iridium model is we have value-added manufacturers and value-added resellers. We enable a lot of small companies in aviation to have recurring revenue streams and then have access to this market and all the different markets. And they innovate. And what I love is when you allow people to innovate because they can make a decent amount of money, it's amazing what they come up with. And so we have all of these companies that innovate and create these amazing products. We have companies that create amazing products that meet the regulatory requirements for tracking helicopters. We have people who make these amazing products for general aviation. We have people who make these amazing products for business aviation and for the air transport market, which are usually the big avionics companies. And then more importantly, on the delivery of the service side, we have these value-added resellers, and we have these amazing companies that said, okay, it's sort of generic. If I buy a certain amount of information from a certain data rate from Iridium, kilobits per second from Iridium for X dollars, and I sell it to so-and-so airplane for Y dollars, that's pretty commoditized. It's hard to say, oh, well, I can provide that. I can bill you better than the other guy can bill you. So what our value-added resellers do is they create all these software services, these data analytics services, these flight tracking services, and they sort of round these things up. So when you go and you buy Iridium services from a value-added reseller, they're typically selling you a whole package of stuff. They're typically selling you things that have data concentration tools that are telling you how you're running your engines, that are telling you, warning you when there's weather or terrain. They're telling you all sorts of things relative to, did you run your engines too hot? Did you not shut them down properly? Tons and tons of tools these people are innovating and developing in order to help airlines, general aviation, business aviation, helicopter, and now drones actually get what they need to operate their aircraft less expensively or more efficiently. So lots of opportunities for small businesses to really innovate and make money off of our network that we spent billions of dollars to put out there.
Are there aspects of critical infrastructure support that you've been involved in?
Yeah, there's quite a bit. So I think one thing you guys would notice is when it comes to doing infrastructure support. So you got to get an airplane or a helicopter to go out, and you got to look at pipelines, to look at high tension wires and all that sort of infrastructure. Typically it's a helicopter, and these things are prone to lots of accidents. So because of that, the drone industry is figuring out how to get a scalable commercial model. So lots of solutions looking for a problem when it comes to drones. I equate it to, if you read back prior to World War I, how many aircraft companies were there around the world when the Wright brothers were doing airplanes? Like there were just hundreds of them, hundreds and hundreds of them. Every country had dozens of aircraft manufacturers, everyone trying to figure out how to make their way, right? And that's really what the drone market is today. There's just thousands of companies that make these amazing products, but they're trying to find these scalable solutions to get them into infrastructure. So delivery and infrastructure seem to be two areas that permit them to scale and find real revenue, a real commercial model. And so they're using Iridium for and satellite communications for beyond visual line of sight operations. And part of that is we just got American Aerospace and Chevron just got a waiver where they're going to operate at 5,000 feet up to 8,000 feet. They're going to operate a fixed wing drone that's a little over 200 pounds. And this just came out. So this is new news, the 200 pound drone. And they are going, this drone can be up for like 10 to 12 hours. And it can go up and just, it has all the sensors and all the equipment and all the cameras on it so that it can monitor pipelines. And now you don't have to put physical people in small aircraft to monitor these pipelines. It's a fantastic accomplishment. This tiny little company has innovated. We are so proud to work with them on that. And the fact that they made this accomplishment, once one person figures out how to solve the problem and get some scale in a commercial model, it allows all these other little companies, sort of paves the way for all the other little companies to find their piece of it as well. So a lot of different innovative ways people are using satellite communications, our satellite communications, because they're so reliable. No matter where you are, pipelines, like unless you live in Chicago, people don't really want pipelines in their backyard. So what you got to do is they're out in the middle of nowhere. So that's where these guys fly these drones, is out in the middle of nowhere. And so you don't have a lot of cell phone infrastructure out there. So this is a great product to use when there's nothing else. Plus, when you're over 5,000 feet, your LTE becomes sporadic. It doesn't work real reliably. And when you have a remote pilot in charge, making decisions, maintaining separation, and ensuring that they are performing the mission, no matter what the winds or the weather is, you've got to have a reliable communication link. And that's why they use us.
So, John, what's the actual size of an Iridium satellite? And I'm curious, what's their lifespan and what happens to them when they finally die?
So this is the most wonderful thing. So Iridium satellites, so the size of them, they're about the size of a Volkswagen Jetta. That's about how big they are with big wings. Imagine, remember the old flying cars? That's about how big they are when their solar array is deployed. So it's about the size of them. They last 20 years. And when they're all used up and they're done, we push them down into the atmosphere where they burn up. And so they're gone. So they're not a part of the environment anymore. No space junk, no nothing. I would say that the geostationary satellites use the last of their fuel to push themselves up out of the orbit, and then they float out there forever. So it's kind of like when you take your McDonald's bag and throw it out the window of your car and it sits on the side of the road. That's sort of how those geos are when they're all done and used up.
And used up normally relates to the, using up the fuel. Is that right? For positioning itself?
Not really. To be honest with you, No. Space. So first of all, space is a vacuum. So heat's a problem. You know, you watch the movies and everybody turns to ice and you think it's cold in space. But once you have friction and heat gets generated, how do you get rid of it when there's no wind, there's no nothing, right? So if you think about satellites, everything on a satellite is an electrical component. And usually what happens before you run out of fuel, because people are pretty good at managing the fuel, just the electronics just wear out. The electronics, 20 years out in the vacuum of space is a long time for electrical components when you can't get rid of the heat. So the stuff just wears out.
So are there more Iridium satellites that will be launched into orbit?
We are done. Our last launch was last year, and we put the last of our spares up. So we are done until we're ready for our next constellation, whenever that is in the future.
And in terms of that next constellation, what can you tell us about you're looking at in terms of developing it for the next 20 years in terms of new things we might be looking at. Just generally, I don't want you to give away any company secrets.
So if you take a look at where Iridium is headed in the press releases and where all of space is headed in general, it seems to get bifurcated into just a few categories. You know, one category is just what's in our wheelhouse. There's very few people that do it in space. We own our spectrum and L-band. And so that safety piece will always be there because we're the most trusted communication that's out there. So the safety piece will always be there. Then there's another piece of it that's real important to people. And this has to do with taking that safety and is always available and putting it into what they call these narrowband IoT or these direct-to-device type technologies. So when you go out into the world and something happens and there's no cell phones around, you just point it at a satellite and send a message. And so that is the next place we see a lot going. We just press released, we're doing something called 3GPP. That's actually a protocol so that when you buy a Android phone, an Iridium service would automatically work on it. So, and if you think of 802.11 and things like that, you know, you have A, B, C, D, F, and N, and so on and so forth. And as each new version of that comes out, it performs better. So when the next version of 3GPP comes out, it'll be the best version ever because Iridium will work on it. And those are the sorts of things that we're heading in as well. And then there's another part of all of this that's important to us, and that's our IoT, our Internet of Things. So how do you track a package? How do you track a container? How do you track whatever you need to track in everywhere in the world? How do you keep track of your cows when it's spread out over tens of thousands of acres? So getting these things down so that they're very tiny, super inexpensive, they cost pennies to keep track of these things. That's, I think, the real direction a lot of these satellite technologies will be headed to.
Maybe, John, we could, or you could mention the aviation statement on handhelds.
Yeah. Getting into some of the conversation and the news that we were having around next generation and things like that, something that I get really excited about is when we were working with drones, we wrote this white paper that showed that, hey, with off-the-shelf technology, a 1090 or 978 megahertz in a satellite connection, we can maintain separation with a remote pilot in charge, all the latencies taken into account, and a remote pilot in charge anywhere in the world monitoring an aircraft could actually maintain TCAS-2 separation from another aircraft. And what I mean by that is, when you take a look at your traffic advisory, your resolution advisories, and those sorts of things, you want to be 2 to 5 miles apart in separation. And so if you have two aircraft below 18,000 feet converging on each other at the maximum allowable speed of 250 knots, if that's going on and somebody breaks my bubble for 5 miles out, can I make sure that we don't close and hit each other? Because I might not be able to reach that person on the radio and they can't see me. I'm in a drone. It's small. And any of us who fly know how hard it is to see another airplane, even when you know it's out there and you're looking for it, much less you're just scanning the horizon and you're not sure it's there. And so what we noticed was all of the communications from a 5 mile break to the bubble takes 18 seconds to get completely out of its way. And when you do the math around the closure rates, carry the one and divide by two, you find out that in that 18 seconds, you can maintain more than 2 miles of separation if they were on dead reckoning headings. I say all these things because that's only if you can see it. So above 18,000 feet, we've got rules on 1090 megahertz. Has to be there. You don't get a choice, right? But what happens when you're below 18,000 feet and you're flying a Piper Cub, or you're flying an experimental, or you're in a parachute, or you're in a balloon? Well, there aren't any real rules about that, right? And so you say, oh, well, I'm just going to make everybody spend tens of thousands of dollars and put on surveillance systems and put power systems on to power them and make sure that they have all this STCs and these zillions of dollars it takes in order to maintain these things and have them inspected and all this stuff. And when you think about it and you play it out, in Europe and Australia, they come up with these very clever devices, and U.S. companies are making these devices. They're just not allowed to sell them here. And these devices are handheld transponders, and they get a 30-mile range. And so you plug this thing in like your mobile phone, you lick it and stick it to the side window, and you let it rip. It's ADS-B out, ADS-B in. So inside the aircraft, it's telling you all the other aircraft that are around you that have surveillance. You're no different than the FAA, and it shows up on your iPad or your iPhone on whatever your app is that you're using. So let's say Four Flight's the app you're using. It's very popular, right? And it shows up on your Four Flight app. And now you know the ADS information. So you know their heading, their aircraft type, their speed. You know everything about them sitting there in your Piper Cub, just trucking around to your favorite hunting spot or fishing spot. And to bring that level of visibility to these folks for a couple of $100, it's a fantastic thing. But here's the more important part of it. If you've got a drone that's out there flying around with a remote pilot in charge, the FAA may not see that handheld surveillance device because the altitude that it's flying, it can't see a ground station. Or if you're in the middle of Alaska, there aren't any ground stations in the middle of Alaska, right? Now that drone's clipping along there, guess what? That handheld that's ADS-B out, ADS-B in, the ADS-B out, ADS-B in that's on the drone can see it. The drone takes all the ADS-B inputs it gets and sends it over an Iridium satellite link. Guess what the remote pilot in charge sees? Sees that other aircraft. And it sees that other aircraft 30 miles away. And it can monitor that aircraft, and it can make sure it maintains separation. So you get this opportunity to delegate some separation down into the general aviation space and to do it safely for just a couple $100. And people get concerned about, well, what if the batteries go dead? Well, what if they don't mount it right in the window? Well, if you play the statistics on it, isn't that still better than nobody having it? Like, so it's sort of an idea that I would love to see more momentum on, because we're seeing it work so well with the test flights we do in drone, and we're seeing high adoption of it in places like England and on Australia, but we're not permitting it in the United States because we're not doing an STC to install it on an aircraft, or to have it on a parachutist, or to have it on a balloon, or to have it on a drone. So I think there's a lot more we could all do there as an aviation community to say, boy, this makes a lot more sense and makes things safer. I personally talk to pilots who use these things. They use them in the U.S. for the ADS-BN. That's permitted in the U.S. You're just not allowed to use the out, but you can use the in. I talk to pilots. Typically, the ones who love it the most are the guys who are flying in and out off of lakes, because they're taking off of lakes and they can't see what's above them or what's coming over the hill or the horizon or something like that. And this takes care of it because it sees them, because of the squawk. And so many of them have told me that they've avoided, not necessarily avoided an accident, but they sure as heck avoided a close call and made a better decision because the information was right there in front of them on their iPad. They didn't have to go get tens of thousands of dollars of avionics to make this happen. I think that's where technology should be helping us.
So what needs to happen? Is it the aviation alphabet groups need to be involved?
Yeah, I think AOPA needs to take a bigger role. I think these companies that do these drone exponential and those sorts of companies need to take a bigger role around this with the FAA. And, you know, they bring them in on a panel and say, tell me about BVLOS, but why aren't they telling them, you know, you can make it safer if we have more tools available at a lower price to more pilots? And then let's let them figure out the airspace for the remote and rural airspace. We don't want pilots making up their own mind 40 miles from a hub, right? That's not a good plan. What we got today is great. It's safe. I love it. Keep me out of the places I can't get into. But when we're in remote and rural areas, I really think these are the sorts of things we should be bringing into play. And I would love to see more education about this on programs like yours and more attention on this by the AOPA, the experimental pilots as well, getting more involved and really getting. And if you think about how electronics work, imagine if this type of technology was available to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of pilots, how much cheaper that technology would be for them to buy it from the few avionics companies that make that stuff. And these are little companies.
Just for clarification, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. There's a gadget, a name brand, Stratix, is ADS-B dual band receiver. What you're talking about is a receiver and a transmitter. Yeah. That's like the same type of thing. And I guess the question I had is I thought that all aircraft were currently required to have an ADS-B out transmitter built into them.
Those ADS-B out transmitters under requirement depend upon the class and weight of the aircraft and what airspace it's going to fly in. So you don't have to have them if you don't fly in certain airspaces.
Gotcha.
What I want to see is, I just want to see more safety in general. I want to see it delivered affordably, though. I don't like these mandates that cost tens of thousands of dollars and take perfectly good general aviation pilots out of piloting because it's too expensive. It breaks the clubs down as well, which I don't want to see. But I want to see these low-cost technologies get in and we get more safety.
Yeah, pretty good. All right, John, if people want to learn more about Iridium, what's the best way to do it? Probably the website?
Yep, go to iridium.com, click on aviation, and that is where you would be. And I'll tell you, Max, a great company for you to talk to about these handhelds and these types of technologies is UAvionics, if you haven't talked to them yet. Great company.
Nice, I know them.
Founder of that company is fantastic. I didn't see them in your podcast list, but they're doing some really amazing things for general aviation.
Okay, good. We'll follow up with that. All right, John, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I love talking about this stuff. I very much enjoyed being with you guys, and I hope it was fun for you as well. This is fantastic.
The fun part was listening to the show and then hearing a we could hear somebody snorking or giggling or something in the background. We weren't quite sure if that was you or not, but
no, that was Micah. I saw him. Micah did not hit his mute, and you were saying things, and then he just started laughing in the background.
It was me. It was Micah. Sure. Yeah.
All right, what's up with the geeks? David, what's your current project look like over at the museum?
Rockets and Rotors is rapidly coming together. The Charles Schulz exhibit is done. I'm in the process of gathering all of the artifacts for the incorporation of how helicopters affect the space program. There's a long history of helicopters interacting with space capsules, especially after they've splashed down, and the role current, you know, now that we've returned to space here in the United States, and unlike other countries, we land people in water. Again, we're going back to splashdowns and helicopter recovery. So that exhibit will be opening May 24th, and will run till September 1st, 2024.
Very cool. All right. We look forward to that. You may see me stop in, David, someday to check that out. Let's see. Micah, what's up with you?
Well, this week, episode 72 of the Journey is a Reward podcast is released, and we talk about Brian's real Singapore vacation. I mean, he's been there many times, but this he went for a full week for a vacation. He took one of his neighbors, and it's the first of a two-part series on his trip to Singapore, and he had a good time.
Well, I didn't realize that this was a real trip to Singapore. I mean, the one where he didn't just land and turn around and come back to get the miles. So, looking forward to that. And it's going to be in two parts, you say?
Two parts. First part just came out this week. Not sure if the second part's going to be released next week or if there'll be a week break in between. But he certainly had a lot of fun, and I made him go to Raffles and buy another $40 Singapore sling.
All right. So folks can look for the Journey is the Reward podcast, wherever fine podcasts are given away for free. Look forward to that.
Hi, Max and team. I just wanted to let you know that we have the best listeners in the podcast world. If you remember, a few weeks ago, I put out a call for people to help out with a project I'm working on at the California Science Center. For those of you who didn't hear the request for help, well, the California Science Center is taking a bunch of kids from a disadvantaged region in Los Angeles and putting them through an 8-week program to introduce them to aviation. We're not only focusing on becoming a pilot, but we want to expose them to all the other great areas of aviation. For example, becoming an AMP, being involved in flight planning, dispatch, weather. You know, there are so many areas of aviation, we really want to expose them to everything possible. My request was to see what our listeners could contribute, and I received some pretty great responses. By the way, if I didn't get back to you, that means that your email fell through the cracks when I was in Singapore, so please send me another email and accept my apologies. I promise you, I will get back to you because we definitely need your help. Anyway, I'm still looking for some people to contribute to the program. If anyone has access to a plane or a hangar in Southern California and wouldn't mind showing the kids your aircraft and the hangar itself, that would be great. If you're a mechanic and can show the kids what it's like to work on an aircraft, that would be wonderful. If you work for a company that has some logo wear and you can donate it to the program, these items would be greatly appreciated. If you're an air traffic controller, or if you work in dispatch, or can spend an hour or so on Zoom talking to the kids about what a day in your life is like, that would be fantastic. Basically, I'm looking for anything that can add value to the program and expose these kids to as many aspects of aviation as possible. Again, thank you so much for all the people who sent in their ideas and offered to contribute. Your generosity is greatly appreciated. And if you have an idea or work in an area of aviation that I haven't thought about, please let me know. You can send me an email at brian@theairplanegeeks.com. The entire team of the California Science Center, as well as myself, really appreciate your generosity. Thank you for being the best listeners on the planet. Fly safely, Brian.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Not sure how this one is going to sound, at least on the part of my audio, given some problems I'm having. Our guest this episode, again, was John Peterson, Executive Director at Iridium Communications Aviation Line of Business. Check out iridium.com. They've got that organized pretty nicely into the different sectors that they, different industry sectors that they cover. So you can get right to the aviation part of that pretty easily. And you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes are there. If you want to go right to the show notes for this episode, well, you know the code. It's airplanegeeks.com/798. That's the episode number. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
I think Rob had one more thing to say before we finish this up, didn't he?
I did, actually. And I'm not quite sure how this goes, but a one, a two, a one, two, three, four.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear X.
Happy birthday to you and many more.
Wow, thank you. Well, that was a surprise. I wasn't sure what was going to happen.
What would have been really nice is we were going to try to have a balloon filled with confetti over the top of your head in the trailer, but we couldn't figure out how to get it. It just didn't come together.
The iridium stuff that we were supposed to have to coordinate it just didn't arrive yet. That's the whole problem.
I see. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you guys. Thank you.
Are we going to have to do another show like this?
We need to sign off so Max can spend the next week figuring out how to do his audio so we don't have this issue next week.
Oh, I know. I am perplexed. But meantime, Micah, tell folks where they can find you.
Well, you can find me with Pasadena Brian Coleman, our former associate producer on the Journey is Reward podcast. That's the journeyisreward.org. And you can also find me on Twitter. I'm still there. And it's at MainFly, M-A-I-N-E, the state. Fly, let's go fly. MainFly on Twitter.
Terrific. And Rob Mark, how about you?
They'll find my moniker in a number of aviation publications around the country, but also every week or two at jetwine.com with Scott Spangler.
Okay. How's Scott doing these days, by the way?
He's doing pretty well for an old guy. I mean, you know, geez.
We're all old guys.
I was going to say, today, not only is it your birthday today, Max, it would have been my mom's 112th birthday today. Unfortunately, she didn't make it quite this far. But so appreciate your mom while you have her, and don't say bad things to her, or don't let anybody else say bad things to your mom, like some people have been known to do, because it'll come back to haunt them. Won't it, Micah?
It might. I don't know. It might.
All right. David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
Yeah, you can find me at the American Helicopter Museum. You can find me next week at Disney World. I will be flying on Spirit Airlines down and back. So they saved me last year because Frontier canceled my flight. The family is going down to Orlando to get a Disney trip in.
We should get you for do a trip report for us as a guest on the Journey is Reward podcast.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Absolutely, David. You should think about that. All right. You can write to me at maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. And so we'll sign off and say, so please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Have a great week.
Nighty night.
Thanks for listening.